Thanks everyone for coming. We're slightly worried about the battery here, but we'll see what happens. So I know we're getting late in the program now. Energy reserves may be dwindling. Thanks for sticking around for another couple of days. I told most of my high-energy senior friends not to come in the interest that this should really be about the students. So please ask questions throughout. I don't care how simple they are. If you're confused about it, someone else is confused about it too. I'm happy to discuss it. If I don't get to the end of what I was going to say, I mean, that's fine. It's better that we all learn something. In these two lectures, I'm going to talk about the black hole information problem. What I say is more or less going to be a proper subset of these lecture notes, which I posted online a couple years ago. Based on a longer lecture course that I gave in Jerusalem. so you can look there if something is confusing, or I guess if you think it's 11 is too early in the morning or something like that. Okay, so the information problem. We all know the basic idea. You have some infalling matter. It's in a pure quantum state. You collapse it to form a black hole. And then after a while, the black hole evaporates back into the radiation cloud. But when it does, the state of the radiation cloud, according to Hawking, is morally speaking, in a thermal mixed state. This is a violation of quantum mechanics, right? Because we prepared the black hole in a pure state. We threw in some collapsing matter in a pure state. And then after the evaporation, we got back a mixed state. And even worse, the mixed state that we got back doesn't seem to depend on which pure state we threw in. Whereas in quantum mechanics, if you have a closed system and you evolve with time, right? You act with a unitary transformation. And so unitary transformations send pure states to pure states, and they're invertible. So both of those seem to be breaking down here. Stephen Hawking, who was the person who figured this out, argued from this that gravity and quantum mechanics can't be consistent with each other. And he was trained as a general relativist, so he likes gravity, so he said quantum mechanics is going to be the one that has to go. Before getting into the details of how and why this happens, let's just try to first sketch some intuition for what leads to this. In probably Veronica's class, you learned about Penrose diagrams. So this is the Penrose diagram of a collapsing black hole, which then evaporates. So the idea is here's an infalling shell of matter. For simplicity, I've made it out of photons, or some other massless quanta. So we just have a null shell of matter coming in here. It collapses. This dashed line horizon forms. Here's the singularity. But then eventually, after the evaporation continues for a long time, then the black hole is gone, and now we're back up here to Minkowski space again. So just in case there's anyone here who didn't go to Veronica's lectures, when we draw these diagrams, this is a representation of the space-time where light moves on 45-degree angles. So just ordinary Minkowski space, we would have drawn it like that. So then light can go in from past infinity and out to future infinity. Here what happens is that under this infalling shell, we kind of have a piece of this Minkowski space. And then up here, after the black hole evaporates, we kind of have another piece of this Minkowski space, right? Because once the black hole is gone, it's gone. We're just back to empty space. So we've got the infalling shell, the horizon, the singularity, and then the black hole evaporates up into here, and then we've got Minkowski space again. Now, why does this lead to information loss? Well, the reason is that there's this singularity here. So in particular, this shell that we threw in to make the black hole ends up in the singularity. And the singularity, as far as this we understand this picture, well, information doesn't go from the singularity back into up here. So if you ask, you know, what kind of information is available on a time slice like that, you know, here's the shell. But then if you look on a time slice like that, well, the shell is still over here and it's not over there, so the information has been lost. And then this thermal state, as we'll see in detail, comes from the splitting of the space-time here along the horizon. As you may remember in Tom Hartman's class, and as we'll discuss more, when you split the vacuum like this, you get a thermal state on one side, and that's morally speaking where the Hawking radiation is coming from. Yes, is there a question? Well, that's a little bit subtle because you don't really know what's going on here. You could imagine that there was some sort of boundary condition here at the end of the evaporation, which you had to specify. I think classically you'd probably say that you would need some sort of boundary condition like that, and then it's not globally hyperbolic. You know, you need some, you know, quantum gravity somehow has to give you some boundary condition there to let you continue. We'll discuss a little bit more, though, about why that may not be such an issue. Yeah.
In minimal space, if you have a political observer in the university, you would also have a growing problem, or would you not?
No, you don't. Yeah, so we're going to discuss Rindler in extent, a lot in a sec, but let me just draw what the picture would have been there. So the thing is, yeah, so you can throw a thing through the Rindler horizon, no problem. But the information is still really up here. So you know, you don't see it if you stay out here, but you just say, okay, that's fine. That's just because you're staying over here and you're only looking at part of the system. And so it's kind of the same thing here. I mean, you might say I'm up here and I'm just no longer looking at this part of the system. So that's what relativists like to say when they say that there's information loss. Yeah, the problem, though, is that here this region kind of just disappears after a while. Okay.
Don't say that.
All right.
You don't know what happens.
See? Right. Right. No. I'm right. So the sort of conventional picture of information loss would be just, you know, you have this sort of region over hanging out over here, and that's where the information is. Right. So, and that could be one of the options, right? I mean, eventually we're going to discuss to what extent that is or isn't a good explanation of what goes on here. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, I know where you're going to go and say, well, okay, but that's inconsistent with other things we believe. But
yeah.
The way you've said it so far, I think it's not clear.
Yeah, so
why
this was just supposed to be the sort of very crude get everyone thinking about these
kinds
of questions.
Yeah, but it's not, the student should not think that it's clear why this would violate quantum mechanics, because there could simply be another factor of Hilbert space inside.
No, I mean, right. So of course that's true. I mean, that's why we're giving a whole lecture about this, and we're not. I mean, that's why the lecture doesn't stop now, right? I mean, so, yeah.
We'll see about that.
All right, bring it on.
So Dan, my question was really innocent and as a student, which is I think you were suggesting that this radiation that we were, this thermal radiation, was independent of size as a way of saying we've lost information about psi. But I was thinking about this Rindler observer as also seeing this some radiation.
Yeah.
And
right.
That had nothing to do with any psi. So.
No, it's really this thing that we were just discussing, though, right? The question is, to what extent are you allowed to think of this as the outside as being a closed system? Right. That's really the question. So with the black hole, there are pretty good arguments that you should think of the outside as a closed quantum evolution. Whereas in Rindler, you kind of don't want to think about that because there's all this stuff over here and it eventually comes out.
You're saying if I would stop
the difference is that here the stuff out here eventually comes out to infinity, and in quantum gravity we kind of tend to think that in some sense the theory is really defined at infinity. Well, you know, as we'll discuss more later. So then this information is really accessible from infinity, whereas the stuff back here, at least if we adopt this picture that it just falls in there into the baby universe, then it's never accessible from infinity. Right. Yeah, yes. That's perhaps the more refined way we can say it that makes Ted happier. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So somehow at some point, we kind of want to take a slice like that and then continue it to a slice like that. And then whether or not we're allowed to do that kind of has to do with what's going on here. And in the bulk, we don't really know how to think about that, right? So, but from the boundary point of view, you don't seem to have that issue. You just have some boundary theory and you're evolving with time. So if you like, the ADM Hamiltonian is living out here and it doesn't care what's going on in here. We'll discuss this in a lot more detail. So I don't want to anticipate the entire lecture series now. All right. So now, the first question probably that we should ask is, why should we care about this? After all, this is not an experiment that we're going to do anytime soon. In fact, we're probably not even going to measure Hawking radiation at all anytime soon. Never mind try and study whether it preserves quantum coherence. A solar mass black hole has a temperature 10 to the minus 6 Kelvin. The wavelengths of the thermal radiation is kilometers. And it's not like they're excited into some coherent state that you pick up with an antenna. They're sort of coming out in individual quanta. So even just detecting them would be very difficult, even if we happen to have a solar mass black hole sitting around. And even if we could, to test this kind of thing, right, we'd have to somehow collect enough of them that we could feed them into a quantum computer and act on them in some complicated way to try and verify whether this is really the state or whether it's pure, or whether it remembers which pure state we made it out of. Why do we care? Okay. I think there's three good answers to that. Maybe the best answer, which I think is due to Edmund Hillary, maybe not someone, is because it's there. Probably for most of us, that's the real reason. It's just hard to resist thinking about it. How can quantum mechanics and gravity be consistent? Some funny thing going on here. Black holes, that's pretty cool. And if that's good enough for you, that's fine. For me, probably it's good enough, but let's just write two more. The second one is really sort of a more serious version of that. So it's because this is really a litmus test for quantum gravity theories. You can think of this kind of being like, when Einstein was thinking about special relativity, he was thinking about trains that are moving at almost the speed of light. We still don't have trains that are moving almost the speed of light. In fact, in the United States, my country, we're very far from having trains that move at the speed of light. But they were still useful to think about, right? They had sort of these very sort of simplified thought experiments can help you guide you to the right way of thinking about the problem. Even if you're never going to have trains moving at the speed of light. If someone comes up to you, on the street or in the seminar room, and has a quantum gravity theory that they're trying to sell you, you should ask them, Is information lost? And what's the calculation that tells you the answer? And if they can't answer that, then you shouldn't buy their theory of quantum gravity. Right? So that's what I mean by a litmus test. All right, and then the final reason, more practical, is we keep learning cool stuff. Right. So although we still haven't solved this problem, we've learned all sorts of fun stuff along the way, and every generation goes through being confused about this problem and learns interesting things out of that. And even if our generation won't be the one that solves it, we'll probably learn some cool stuff. Okay. So that was just sort of by way of motivation. Today I will discuss in more detail how this evaporation works. Write some equations. Try and formulate this information problem a little better. And then tomorrow I'll talk about the ADS-CFT version of the information problem. So that one has maybe the disadvantage that it's kind of less visceral than this one, but it has the major advantage that we can really write down all the equations. It gives us a very sharp testing ground for playing with these ideas. Although we'll see, actually, even there, we haven't really understood everything. There are things that still we need to understand better. All right, so now we're going to start talking about Rindler space. Okay, so now the next hour is just going to be lots of fun with free field theories and various configurations. So we're going to review Rindler quantum mechanics. Tom Hartman and Mark Mazet, already in their lectures, told you several things about Rindler space. So probably the first thing they told you is that in Minkowski, just in ordinary Minkowski space, you can prepare the ground state wave function by doing a Euclidean path integral, which you run back to minus infinity in Euclidean time. So this is something like d phi, let's call this phi tilde up here, e to the minus s. Right. So we do the path integral with a boundary condition. We do the path integral on the lower half plane with the boundary condition here, which is the argument of the wave function, and that computes for us the ground state wave function of the quantum field theory. Really not too mysterious. I mean, it also computes the ground state of the harmonic oscillator if you do that. So it's a fairly simple idea. Just, we evolve for e to the minus ht for a long time. That projects onto the ground state. Psi is the ground state. The ground state, on the whole time slice. So now what Tom and Mark also explained to you, I think, is that if we cut the system in half, we take the same path integral, but now instead of interpreting it going like that, right? Like, that's the sort of e to the minus ht interpretation. We instead interpret it kind of by going around that way. So it's the same path integral, so it's still computing this. But now we could split into left and right parts of phi. This tells us that this ground state has this nice, simple, entangled form. Let's see, what am I doing here? Pi. Where this, I left, or I right and I star left are complete bases for the field configurations here. And they're chosen, so remember, the way you thought about this was that you do this Euclidean rotation, which is like a boost in this plane. So then the boost operator, which you can view as the sum of a right part and a left part, right? There's the part that kind of does this, and that acts just on these, and there's the part here that just acts like that. And then these states here are eigenstates of those. So this KXR IR equals EI IR. And this KX left acting on I star left is EI I star left. So in particular, if we look at the reduced density matrix just on the right side, we get a thermal distribution, 2 pi EI II. Okay. So that's the sort of formal argument that if we make this cut and we just live on this side, then the state looks thermal. Now, in principle, we could proceed along these rather formal lines and derive pretty much everything that we need. But I thought that it would be better for helping everyone get intuition to understand these things in an example, in a theory where we can actually compute this stuff. I mean, these are still kind of formal objects, right? I mean, the eigenstates of half of the boost operator, well, what are those anyway? You know, what do those look like? What if you stumbled into one in a dark alley at night, you know, what would it be like? Well, in a general quantum field theory, I can't really tell you, but in free field theory, I can tell you. I'm now gonna work this out in a little more detail. For the special case of a free scalar field, and then hopefully that should help everyone get more intuition for what these things really mean. Okay. So free scalar. So in a free scalar Hilbert space, well, quantum mechanics, so the first thing is we have a Hilbert space which is spanned by an orthonormal basis of field configurations. So this symbol phi is a map, say from R3 to R. And for every such map, we have a state in the Hilbert space, and they're all orthogonal. So that's the Hilbert space. The Hamiltonian is integral over space. So I put a 1/2 here. And then we get the momentum conjugate to phi squared, this gradient of phi squared. And then we can have a mass term. Okay. So from a quantum information theory point of view, we've defined the theory, right? So here's the Hilbert space. Here's the Hamiltonian. Just pick some operators. Off we go. Now, a good operators that we like to think about are the Heisenberg picture fields, right? Defined like that, right? So this phi without the t is the one that just, you know, these are the eigenbasis of it, right? So like for any so the operator, well, this is a little bit dangerous to write, but if I act with the operator phi of x on the state phi. Then I get back phi of x, but now this is a classical function given by this map. So maybe I should put a hat here just for this equation. Okay. Right, so that's the definition of this phi operator. Pi is its canonical conjugate. And then you'll show in the homework, if you don't already know, that this Heisenberg field obeys the wave equation, box phi, which is minus phi double dot plus grad squared phi equals m squared phi. So that's its Heisenberg equation of motion. Well, this is a linear equation, so then any solution of this equation, so here, this is an operator solution, right? We have an operator that obeys this equation, or if you like, we have a family of operators that are related by this equation, say it either way. We can expand it in terms of a complete basis of solutions of the equation. Okay, and here it's easy. We can just do Fourier analysis. So we have fk of t and x, ak, plus fk star, since it's a real scalar field, dagger, where this fk of t and x we can write like that. So, and then this omega k is square root of k squared plus m squared. All right. So for high energy physicists, this is dreadfully boring, I'm sure. But just for the quantum information people, I want to be clear that, I mean, this really is ordinary quantum mechanics, right? We have a Hilbert space, we have a Hamiltonian, we have operators. These are the operators. And in the homework, I asked for, if you haven't done this before in your life, to work out all of this and a few more things about this theory. In particular, the thing that's good to work out is the algebra of these AKs, is the algebra of creation annihilation operators. And in terms of the AKs and AK daggers, the Hamiltonian can be written just like that. So then there's a ground state, which is annihilated by all the A's, and then acting with the A daggers, you get particles, which are eigenstates of the Hamiltonian of definite momentum. You can make wave packets out of them. They don't interact, so they just move around and go through each other. So that's just free scalar field theory in this, just organized in terms of the conventional time, right? But we can do the same thing now for Rindler. So I won't write everything out. It's basically the same. The only difference is that we instead want to pick solutions which are simple from the Rindler point of view. Because the problem is that these A's and A daggers that we wrote down here, well, these create eigenstates of the Hamiltonian H, which is the operator that moves us up and down here, right? But to do this Rindler decomposition, those aren't the eigenstates that we want, right? Like the things that appear here are the eigenstates of the boost operator, right? Like this one is an eigenstate of the right piece of the boost operator, and this one is an eigenstate of the left piece. So what we'd like to do is pick a different set of solutions. So right, this f, you see, it just has definite frequency with respect to the time generated by the ordinary Hamiltonian. But we'd like instead to find some f's which have definite frequency with respect to this Rindler Hamiltonian. The nicest way to do that is to pick new coordinates on Rindler space. So let me again draw this picture. So this is the Penrose diagram version. Let me also just up here draw the ordinary version. So here's x and here's t. And then we have some y directions coming out of the board, which we're not going to touch. So those are the ones that are sort of, so this k, right, it's the boost in the x, between x and t. And then y is just coming along for the ride sticking out of the board. We're not going to do anything to it. So then the idea is, well, we can define now two new sets of coordinates. So I'll call x to be xi right, cosh tau right. And then I'll also consider coordinates where it's e to the minus xi left, cosh tau left. And t is e to the xi right, sinh of tau right. And then I'll also consider e to the minus xi left, sinh of tau left. Now, OK, why did I do that? Well, the reason is because these slices of constant tau are precisely these boost slices. So let me try and do this with colored chalk. Let me try and make that a little better. And then cross in the middle here. So then slices of constant tau are kind of like that. Or in the original coordinates, they're just like that. Right? Right. So these are boosts, right? So boosts, you know, pivot you around like that. And so that this tau is just the time that keeps track of how much you boosted. And then the xi. So those slices are something like this. And over here, they're hyperboloids. And these hyperboloids are boost invariant. So if you at fixed xi do a boost, you stay at fixed xi. That's the point of this definition. Now, why did I write down two different versions? Well, so the ones that I called right are really just the coordinates here in what I'll call the right wedge. So for example, let's just look at those right coordinates, right? So these green slices that are way over here, right along this light cone, right along this horizon, are xi equals minus infinity. Right, so you see, like, if xi is minus infinity and tau is 0, this is 0, right? So that's kind of right here. And then xi equals plus infinity is over here. And then tau equals plus infinity is kind of up here. And tau equals minus infinity is down here. So these r coordinates just cover this part. And then these left coordinates just cover this part, or equivalently that part. So because we have these two different patches, we need some coordinates for this patch and some coordinates for that patch. All right. Is there a question? Now, as Veronica presumably explained to you in her class, you can write the metric of the space-time in whichever coordinates you want, in particular in either of these two coordinates. So indeed, what you find is that in terms of the right coordinates, the metric now looks like this, and it'll be on the homework to work this out, again, if you haven't done it before, plus dy squared. And then that's in the right patch. And in the left patch, we get the other sign. All right, so sorry this may seem a bit dry, but I tried to specifically pick things which I think will not be familiar to quantum information members of the audience, and which I think should be familiar to them. So bear with me. Hopefully, you'll see soon, we'll start getting mileage out of this. So now the idea is we're going to try and come up with a set of solutions like this, so which in general we call modes, so a set of modes, which have definite frequency in these xi and tau coordinates. We'll try to find a f right and left, omega k of tau. Just write it like this. Look for solutions now. So the whole point is we want them to have definite frequency with respect to tau right or left, depending on which side we're on. We'll also take them to have definite momentum in the y directions, right? The ones sticking out of the board, because they're just sort of coming along for the ride. They're going to have to depend on xi in some way, right? So then we'll multiply this by a function. Let me put it here. Xi, right, left, omega k of xi, right, left. And so if we can find a set of solutions like this, then these have definite energy under the Rindler boost, right? Because the Rindler boost is the generator of this tau time. And so then the creation and annihilation operators for these modes will be ones where all of the annihilation operators annihilate the ground state of this k right or k left. And then by acting with the creation operators, we can create the excited states. And then what we'll learn is these modes will give us a picture of what the excited states are like, right? And remember, that's what we wanted, just because this might seem tedious, right? We wanted a picture of what these excited Rindler eigenstates are like, a physical picture, so we know kind of what's going on in them. Yeah?
So you're looking at the eigenvalues of the boost operator.
Yeah.
Is that
No, it doesn't, right? I mean, so... So
the question is whether boost operator has a spectrum bounded below.
Yeah, that's right. So the two-sided boost operator doesn't, right? So this is a little bit subtle. So the boost operator, yeah, I think actually I should probably, well, yeah, I guess I should actually call this minus in the convention that I'm using. So the idea is it has a positive spectrum here. And it has a positive spectrum here. But with the tau convention that I chose, if this is generating tau left, then because of this minus sign, the sum of the two is unbounded from below. So you could see that for example, in this model by just writing this thing out. And you'll see that it's positive. So this thing is, well, yeah, maybe let me not do that. But you can write it out in terms of the stress tensor, and you see it's the integral of something positive. Yeah. And then this one is the integral of something negative. Yeah. We still need this to solve this wave equation. If we now substitute this into the wave equation, which you'll also do on the homework, so I'll just tell you the answer. So the equation of motion tells us that this psi has to obey some non-trivial differential equation. So the right one obeys an equation like this. And then the left one obeys a rather similar looking equation as the squared. Uh, um, e to the minus 2 xi left minus omega squared psi left and k and omega equals 0. Now, I claim that once you stare at these equations, the physics of this Rindler, these Rindler eigenstates should now be totally clear. Why do I say that? Well, because these are really just Schrodinger equations, right? If you look at it. So, right, this is like kind of like p squared, right? And then this is some potential. And then this is the energy, right? Like if I move this omega squared over to the other side of the equation, then we'd just be saying, you know, minus d to xi squared plus v of xi equals omega squared psi, right? So we can really think of these as just single particle. I mean, of course, you know, the mathematically these are the same thing as the single particle Schrodinger equation for a particle moving at some potential. So what are the potentials? On the left side, so v of xi left, that's this one. So that, well, you see it's an exponential, but it's an exponential with a minus sign. So it's like that. This is xi left. And then on the right side, the potential goes the other way, like that. This is v of xi right, and here's xi right. So that now tells us what the physics of these modes is. So in the right wedge, we have the exponential potential like this. So what happens, right, is we can send in modes from minus infinity, and they'll bounce off the potential and come back out to minus infinity, maybe with some reflection, you know, phase. Whereas up here, we'll send in modes from the right in the left wedge. They'll reflect and go back out. So let's think about what that means in this picture here, right? So on the right side, the potential is increasing as we go this way. So there are modes in here near the horizon, right? Actually, many, right? Because remember, xi right going to minus infinity is just here, right? Like this line here is the whole real xi line. So then we've got a whole pileup of these scattering modes here, and they come out for a while, and then they bounce off and come back. And then you see, the higher their mass or momentum in the transverse direction, the higher the potential, so the faster they bounce off. So there's a whole bunch of modes living in this region, you know, sort of living in the Rindler region, which are sort of coming out and bouncing back. And since we know that the ground state is thermal, it means that these modes are excited, right? So that if you were living here, if you were cruising along on one of these constant xi slices, then you would see these modes, right? You would see some thermal gas of these modes sort of coming out of the horizon, coming back. In fact, yeah, so we can even explicitly write out what the ground state looks like. In terms of these modes. So by using this formula that I erased, but which we derive from the Euclidean path integral, so, well, we just have a tensor product over all of the frequency and tangential transverse momenta. And then, well, for each mode, there's some normalization factor that isn't too important. And then we just have a sum over the mode being excited, pi omega n l omega minus k, and n right omega k. Okay, so each mode is just separately thermally excited. What does this thermality really mean? I mean, so now at least we have some picture. Okay, there are these modes. You know, they're coming out, coming back. But you know, what do you really see? You know, it's just the Minkowski vacuum. So if we just sit here, we see nothing, right? But but you know, if we just sat here, we wouldn't be interested in these coordinates, right? So the person who should be interested in these coordinates is someone who's moving along one of these green lines, right? Or here, one of these green lines. That's the person who thinks that this tau is the, you know, that for that person, this tau is their proper time. Huh. Yeah. Oh, just 2 pi omega. Sorry, yeah. Okay. Good. So indeed. So this person. So it's an observer who's moving with constant acceleration, is the kind of observer who likes these coordinates and these modes, right? These are the modes that someone moving with constant acceleration will use to define what they mean by the ground state, right? For them, the ground state is the ground state of this K. So what Unruh explained is that we should really think of that as meaning that if you're moving at constant acceleration, you will in fact, you know, in carrying a detector, you will in fact see thermal excitations, like your detector will click. You know, if your detector is coupled to this field, and it will click until it equilibrates with the temperature, which for fun I'll put in the units, T Unruh, which is given by A, your acceleration, divided by 2 pi C. So in the units I've been working, we can ignore all of these. So I've essentially set the acceleration to 1 because I neglected a dimensionful factor here. Putting it back, it gives you the acceleration. But it's the 1 over 2 pi here is the real mean, right? And you see that here. That's the 2 pi here. So you actually see this, right? And it's an effect that clearly involves both special relativity and quantum mechanics, right? Because if the speed of light were infinite, like in non-relativistic physics, this temperature would be 0. And also, if h bar were 0, then this temperature would be 0. So this is sort of, in some sense, one of the deepest facts about relativistic quantum field theory. You know, it's a thing that, you know, this is sort of the most fundamental feature of it. That there's this effect that you see this temperature, and you actually see it in terms of these modes, right? So you find yourself living in this gas where stuff is sort of in equilibrium, coming out of here and bouncing back, and coming out of here and bouncing back, and at any particular time you see some set of these modes. All right, yeah.
As a person standing here on the surface of the Earth, I'm constantly accelerating. So should I expect to see this kind of temperature?
Yes, you should, but unfortunately the temperature is small. Yeah. So actually in the homework, that's another one of the problems is you're going to compute this for acceleration of 1g.
So why does it have a different interpretation for me standing on Earth or me sitting at some distance from a black hole?
Sorry, what?
Why does it have a different interpretation for a person standing on the Earth or a person sitting outside a black hole?
The black hole?
Or are we not?
Oh, we're going to talk about the black hole in a sec.
Okay.
Yeah. The black hole is a little more complicated. Roughly speaking, it's the same interpretation, right? I mean, this is the source of the Hawking radiation. It's just the difference is that there, you know, at infinity, the time which is natural to you is also the time which, if you're near the black hole, corresponds to being held up by a string or firing your rockets to stay outside. Okay. Now, before I go on to the black holes, though, I just want to make one more comment about this, right? So if you look at this state, you see it's very entangled, right? It's entangled between the left and the right? This N and this N here are the same, right? So mode by mode, there's a lot of entanglement, thermal entanglement between the two sides of the space-time. So you could ask, well, what happens if, instead of considering the pure state, psi naught, we instead just considered the mixed state, rho left tensor rho right. So we just took this state, we traced out to the left or to the right, and then we just took the product of the two states. So for experiments that were done in here or in here, that would have no effect, right? Because the density matrix here and the density matrix here are the same. The only thing we've done is we've destroyed the entanglement across the center here. Um, So you could ask, okay, what's that state like? Well, we can think about it, right? So what happens when you do this is that now the fields that are fluctuating, so you know, in the entangled state, the fields fluctuating here were very closely correlated with the fields that were fluctuating there, right? And the reason that was true was because, the Hamiltonian has a term in it, which is like dx phi squared evaluated x equals 0, right? So there's like there's a gradient across the two sides here in the Hamiltonian. And that gradient term isn't happy unless the field here and the field there are basically doing the same thing, right? So by doing this, we've disrupted that, right? Now the field here and the field here are fluctuating independently. And then so generically, this gradient will be large. So rho left I got by taking this state and taking the partial trace over right. And rho right I got by taking this state and taking the partial trace over left. Okay? But then I just said, okay, now I'm just gonna take those two mixed states and take the tensor product. So that's not the same state, right? I've now thrown out all of the correlation. But I've done it in a way where I preserved the states here and here separately so that I did something which can't be detected by someone who stays in one of these wedges. So in this state right now, these phis are fluctuating independently on the two sides. So what that means, roughly speaking, is that dx phi is of order 1 over epsilon squared, where epsilon is a UV length cutoff. Right? So in continuum quantum field theory, right, there's an infinite amount of entanglement between the two sides, right? One way to see that is that if you look at the two-point correlation function in this theory and you bring the two points together, it diverges. So in order to have this discussion at all, we have to put in some cutoff, and then the fluctuations of the phi near that point will just be set by the cutoff. So phi on this side, right, will be, you know, the phi will be of order epsilon. Phi here will also be of order epsilon. Their difference will also be of order epsilon since they're uncorrelated. And then their difference divided by the separation, which is also epsilon, will be 1 over epsilon squared. So then this contributes to the Hamiltonian, right? So in the Hamiltonian, this term here is really multiplied. Well, there's integral over y, the transverse directions, and then there's a dx from the fact that we're integrating in the x direction. And then now we've got this 1 over epsilon to the fourth here from the square of this. But then this is also order epsilon, and this is just of order the sort of transverse area of the piece of the horizon that we're studying. So this contributes to the Hamiltonian like A over epsilon cubed. So the energy of this state is infinite, right, in the continuum limit. It involves the cutoff in the denominator. So if you like, it's the area and cutoff units, that's A over epsilon squared, times 1 over the cutoff. So what this state really is, out here, everything is fine, right? It looks the same as the vacuum. But it's an infinite energy state. So how can it be an infinite energy state but look like the vacuum everywhere outside? Well, the only way that could happen is if there was something really, really bad sitting right here, right? And well, the really, really bad is just going to spread out like this. So then up here, you're not happy. So this kind of thing has a name. It's called a firewall. This is the technical term for this kind of thing is a firewall. You've discarded the entanglement between the two sides of this region, and you found that created an infinite energy state, which if you go across this horizon, you die. So.
I have a naive question. If you have an infinite energy state, how
Well, so here I'm just doing quantum field theory. So there's no gravity, so it's fine. But you're right that as soon as we include gravity, there will be some large back reaction from this infinite energy here. It still sounds like it would hurt, though, right? It would still probably hurt. Yeah. Yeah.
But in quantum mechanics, there is no way of, through a unitary evolution at least, to go from the ground state to this rho left times rho right.
Yeah, that's right. So were we just doing quantum field theory? I mean, the correct response to this is just to say, Harlow, you idiot, why are you talking about this stupid state? It's never something that we're going to find, right? Probably most of you are thinking that already. But yeah, so the thing is, once gravity is involved, there are now arguments that maybe that you actually this actually isn't so crazy to have arise from unitary evolution. We probably won't get to explain those arguments by the end of the second lecture, but you know, it's the standard sort of firewall arguments. Basically, the issue is that the Hamiltonian here is the one that evolves like this, right? But in gravity, that's not actually the Hamiltonian which you usually use to define sort of ensembles of typical states. You usually use the one at infinity, which is more like the Rindler Hamiltonian. And the Rindler Hamiltonian, well, it suppresses this kind of thing less. So if you worked it out, right? So if you looked at K in the vicinity of the center, this term would instead look like X times dx phi squared. Right, which incidentally you can see has the positivity property I mentioned before. But you see it has this X here, so that gives you an extra epsilon. So then this kind of thing is sort of more allowed in that situation than it would be here. But yeah, I don't want to try and explain that in detail, so yeah. Oh yeah, okay. So the idea was that if we look at phi plus the field on a little bit to the right, then just by dimensional analysis, it has to be over 1 over epsilon because phi has dimension 1 over epsilon, right? And similarly, if we look at phi just to the left, that also has to be of order 1 over epsilon, again by dimensional analysis. So then the derivative is phi plus minus phi minus over epsilon, right? So that's order 1 over epsilon squared. Unless these guys happen to be equal. And then the point is that in this state, they're usually not going to be equal because they're fluctuating independently.
Is there a useful sense in which you could have a little bit of a firewall? I mean, if I want to like physically kill the entanglement little by little instead of going to the product state, but I want to kill some of the entanglement.
Yeah. So this is like the worst thing that you could do, right? So clearly, I don't have to kill all of the entanglements, and probably, I mean, I think the firewall arguments don't even really promise you that you're actually going to get one this bad. It's kind of more of, but it'll be closer to this than it will be to the vacuum. I mean, you'll disrupt the entanglement enough that it'll still hurt when you go through. All right, so that's basically all I wanted to say about Rindler. Hopefully that helps with some intuition. So now let's talk about black holes. Okay. So in Veronica's lectures, you presumably saw this Penrose diagram for the Schwarzschild geometry. That's the Penrose diagram of Schwarzschild. So out here, it describes a wormhole between two asymptotically flat regions, right? So this is the right exterior, and this is the left exterior. Up in here, we have the sort of future interior, and then there's a singularity here, and then down here we have the past interior, and there's a singularity there. So the usual coordinates for this look like this. Plus r squared d omega squared, where this is just the metric on the round two sphere. And then these coordinates, well, so let's draw another one of these kinds of pictures. The slices of constant t, this time here, look like this. And then the slices of constant r look like this. So these Schwarzschild coordinates are kind of like these psi right, tau right coordinates, right? So here these just cover this part of Rindler space, and here these just cover this part of the Schwarzschild geometry. And then the basic idea is going to be that, well, what's going on sort of near the x here is basically the same as what's going on near the x here. And we can actually be explicit about that. So another coordinate transformation, sorry. So there's something called tortoise coordinates, which we're going to need to use in a sec. So we just redefine r. The metric. Oh, and sorry, from now on, I'm going to set 2gm to 1. Otherwise, we have to write it all the time. The advantage of these coordinates is that now the t and the r have the same factor in front of them. Okay. So in particular, null, you know, light rays that are radial move at 45 degrees in terms of these t and r star. So that's why we like t and r star. Why did I do that? It's a little bit confusing because I switched to r star, but then I still have r here. That's because it's kind of annoying to invert this function. To invert it, you have to use some special function. I think it's called Lambert's W function. So it's a little bit annoying. To make the equation simple, I'll sometimes write things in terms of r instead of r star. If you look near the horizon, if you don't, you know, so the horizon being r equals 1 now, right? That's here. Then this equation is easy to solve, right? So if r is near 1, right, then this log is bigger than that, right? This is just 1, and then this is diverging logarithmically. So for r approximately 1, we have that r star, or let's write it this way, that r minus 1 is just e to the r star, right? So that means that this factor here just becomes e to the r star. I think I erased it. Let me write it again here. Remember these Rindler coordinates, right? What we had was that plus dy squared. So you see it's kind of the same thing, right? This is e to the 2 xi, and this is just e to the r star. Actually, the geometry here is really the same as Rindler in this region near the horizon. You also have to zoom in on the sphere enough so that it looks like these y directions. Let me just draw that. So what we learned is that in Rindler space, if we just kind of look in this shaded region here, the geometry is just the same as in the Schwarzschild geometry if we look in this shaded region here. And now, but it's the same, but not quite, right? Because you see, there's one kind of annoying thing, which is that there's a 2 here, but there's not a 2 here, right? So if I want to put that 2 back, what I have to do is I have to define psi right being like 2 or being a 2 psi right to be r star, right? But then I'm going to get an annoying factor of 2 here, so then I also have to define 2 tau right to be like t, right? So and then the 2 will work out, and I'll get something that looks like that. So what that suggests is that T Hawking, which is the temperature which we should associate to the black hole, should just be like T unruh over 2 because of this annoying 2 here. So then it should be 1 over 4 pi. So then if we now restore the units, it should be h bar c cubed over 8 pi g m k Boltzmann. Right. So just the idea being that, you know, we want the state here, in the black hole, to not have this huge energy cost. So we need the modes here to be correctly entangled. And that means that with respect to this Schwarzschild time, which is 2 times the Rindler time, we better be at the unruh temperature over 2, which is 1 over 4 pi. And then now remembering that we set 2gm to 1, so then we put back a 2gm here, and then we put back some h bars and c's and so on. So this is Hawking's formula for Hawking radiation. Again, we can check that it behaves the way we want. So you see it involves h bar and c, but now you see something interesting. It also involves g Newton. If you imagine the mass being finite, then if you want this to be finite, g also needs to be finite. And so then this is something that involves quantum mechanics, special relativity, and gravity. All right. That was just sort of a local analysis of what's going on. Yeah.
Is that physics not factoring too, or is it just
unknown? You have to get it right. I mean, it really just has to do with how you sew the Rindler region here onto the asymptotic Schwarzschild time, which is asymptotically flat. And it just happens to be 2. I couldn't have predicted that it was 2 without doing the calculation. Yeah.
I'm confused by some very basic thing. Since the metric near the horizon looks like Rindler, then Rindler temperature diverges when you go close to the Rindler horizon. The temperature is a finite value.
That has to do with, right? So I defined the Rindler. Remember when I was defining this coordinate transformation over here, I suppressed the length scale, right? Because this x and t are dimensionful, and this is dimensionless. So when I did that, implicitly what I was doing was I was picking one of these green slices to be special. And then the temperature I compute here is the temperature of that one. So there it was arbitrary. But here it's not arbitrary because the t is picked so that at infinity, as r goes to infinity, this is just minus dt squared. So then when I match on, that's what ensures that I have to pick this to be the scale and not something else.
I see. So an observer at infinity will see a finite temperature, but in the Rindler case, an observer at infinity will see zero temperature.
Yeah, that's right. So this region of the black hole is sometimes called the Rindler atmosphere or the atmosphere, right? It's the stuff that's sort of just above the horizon. It's kind of a hot gas, right? It's kind of like the atmosphere, right? You know, so if you're down in the atmosphere, you know, it's hot. And then, but you know, out here, things might be different. I mean, they will be different. It'll just be more like being in the vacuum. Okay. Now, to get a better global picture of what's going on here, right? I mean, so to understand what happens to these modes in terms of what's going on out here, we're gonna need to do a little better than this. I mean, this was pretty crude. So we're actually gonna have to solve the wave equation throughout this region here if we wanna understand how these Rindler kind of modes here are related to what's going on out there. So I'll just say a little bit about that. Wave equation. So for simplicity, I'm now just going to consider the massless case. So box phi equals zero. So then it turns out that, and now we're going to look for these mode type functions again, which are now going to be a function of these Schwarzschild coordinates. So we can look for solutions basically the same kind of form. So, and then there's e to the minus I omega t. So we look for modes which have definite energy with respect to the Schwarzschild time. We'll take them to have definite angular momentum on the sphere. So this is a spherical harmonic, but don't worry, it won't be on the final. And then again, we have some radial wave function, a radial piece of the mode, which depends on this radial coordinate. And then going through the song and dance of working out what the wave equation is, which again is on your homework, so you should do it if you haven't done it before, we find this Schrodinger kind of equation. So again, we have the modes throughout the Schwarzschild, throughout this right exterior of the Schwarzschild geometry are just described by this single particle Schrodinger equation kind of thing with some potential. But now this potential is not just the exponential that we had before, it's a little more complicated. So that's what it is. Now, you know, it's amazing how much black hole physics is actually in this formula for the potential. You know, looks rather unassuming, maybe just some function of r. Let's think about what it does. So the first thing we can do is just comment on its asymptotic forms as r goes to infinity, right over here, or as r goes to being near the horizon. So when r goes to infinity, which is the same as that's r star going to infinity, it just falls off like some power, r star squared. And then as r star goes to minus infinity, so remember r star going to minus infinity, right? That's what happens when r goes to 1. So that's going near the horizon. And then we already did that calculation. So we find this exponential. Right, so this is like the exponential that we found for Rindler, right? But we see now that exponential is just over here near the horizon. So we have this growing exponential, but then at some point it turns over, and then it falls back off like power. Now instead of having a scattering problem where we just come out of, you know, we come out of the horizon, we bounce off and go back, now there's a new thing that can happen, right? So you know, if we're low energy, most of the time when we go out there, we'll bounce back. But every now and then, we can tunnel through the barrier and make it out to infinity. Okay? And there are sort of three kinds of modes, right? So there are modes where the frequency, you know, where omega squared is higher than this barrier. So those are modes with high frequency, right? So like say if I send one of those here, it just goes over the barrier and falls in, right? So that's like us. Like if I were to go, you know, or you were to get tired of this lecture and go and throw me into some black hole, which was much bigger than me, I would not scatter off of the potential barrier and go back out, right? I would just go straight in, right? And so from this picture, that's because I'm way up here. So this barrier is negligible. I'll just cruise right over it. Okay. But then the interesting kinds of modes, of course, are the ones where the frequency is low enough that this barrier is actually important. And then there are two kinds of modes. There are modes where you come in from the left, right? And then you bounce off, and then there's a little bit of tunneling through. So maybe let's call those red modes. And then there are blue modes where we come in from the outside and bounce off, but then a little bit gets in, right? So these red modes are sometimes called atmosphere modes or modes in the zone, I guess is a term people sometimes use. And they're confined to be near the black hole, right? So these red modes, they basically just live in this shaded region. And they're thermally excited. These blue modes are out at infinity. You know, maybe they come in and bounce off a little bit and then go back out. They're not confined to be near the zone, and they live out here. All right. Now, the key question for us, of course, is in the ground state, or in whichever state we're interested in, which of the modes are excited and how are they excited, right? That's the real physics question. I mean, so far we've just been describing possible states. Yes? Yeah, so this metric has a symmetry under time translation, right? T goes to T plus delta or something. So I pick the modes to have definite frequency with respect to that. So they're eigenstates of the Rindler analog of the boost. I mean, sorry, the Schwarzschild analog of the boost. But now you see that's just the ordinary Hamiltonian, because at large r, this just goes to 1. And then this is just the time as measured by somebody who's far away from the black hole. For someone far away. Yeah, that's right. So near the horizon, it becomes the Rindler Hamiltonian. That was kind of the point of this argument. So near the horizon, it's the Hamiltonian, which is interesting for someone who's staying at fixed r, right? Which is not a necessarily easy thing to do if you're near the black hole, right? The black hole wants to pull you in. So you have to either be firing your rockets or holding onto a string. But I mean, that was true in Rindler too, actually, right? We saw that you had to be accelerating uniformly. So again, you have to be firing your rockets. But here there's this funny interplay where the time for someone just sitting out here minding their own business is the same as the time for someone here who's you know, desperately trying to escape falling into the black hole. Yes? Yeah, that's right. Yes, absolutely. So there are coordinates which just go like this. They're called Kruskal coordinates or Kruskal Szerecis coordinates. I'm not Hungarian. I think it's Hungarian, so I don't know how to say it. Kruskal Szerecis coordinates. Those are different. So the thing is, those coordinates have less symmetry, right? So you see, there's only one time-like isometry of this geometry, and these coordinates are aligned with it. For example, here I was able to separate the differential equation into ODEs, and I wouldn't be able to do it for those. So the modes are more complicated. But you can pick whichever modes you want. I mean, if you're thinking about infalling observers, you probably would want to pick modes like that. But currently, we're trying to understand the black hole from the point of view of someone who stays outside. That's the information problem, right? You stay outside and collapse and then see what comes out. Good. So now we're thinking about, okay, so in the states that we care about, which of the modes are excited? Okay. So one picture, which I'll just mention briefly, which is the one that I think Tom Hartmann already explained, is that you can think about the black hole being in thermal equilibrium. So what that means is you have a gas of radiation outside at some definite temperature, which is in thermal equilibrium with the black hole. And then in that situation, you can think about compactifying Euclidean time, and you can draw this cigar kind of picture. And you can see that the temperature is given by this. So I won't go through that because Tom already went through it, and I think also that's a little bit more counterintuitive. So, so once you conclude that the black hole can be in equilibrium with this temperature, then you conclude that it also must spontaneously emit at this temperature if you put it in contact with, you know, the vacuum, and that's correct. But we're going to try and see the evaporation, or at least sketch a little bit the evaporation from a more physical point of view. Yeah. Yeah.
So we need what we're functioning constructed from, and then we're trying to see how it looks.
Yeah.
What's the equivalent?
Yeah, so that state is this, that's the thing I just mentioned. So that's this Hartle-Hawking state here, where you have a thermal gas out here and here, and then they're entangled.
But why would we want this state?
That's why I'm giving you a different argument. I mean, so that one is good for describing thermal equilibrium with a radiation gas, but maybe you don't care about that. I mean, so that's fine. That's why I'm telling you the other thing. No, but I'm not going to use that state. I'm about to tell you. Okay. So I mean, the real question is, okay, we take an actual black hole that we made. What state is it going to be in, right? I mean, that's the physics problem, right? And that's what Hawking did in his original paper. He didn't do this periodic Euclidean time and stuff, right? I mean, so you know, we just do this thing which I already drew. So we make the black hole by collapsing a shell of matter. And then the rule is we don't throw in anything else. Okay? That's the state. We just throw in this shell, and other than that, on this slice here, we just have the vacuum. Okay? And then the question is, in that state, now so up here now it just looks like this part of the Schwarzschild geometry, and we can write down these modes, and we can ask up here which of the modes are excited. Okay, that was the physics question that Hawking answered in his paper. Now, unfortunately, the calculation is in principle simple, but it's complicated enough that I don't think I can explain it to you here. But let me at least just try to sketch the basic idea. So the idea is these modes, right? So there are modes. There are these modes that are sort of escaping out here. And the interesting question is: are any of these escaping modes excited? So here's one of these escaping modes, right? It's coming out here. Should be blue, I guess, but okay, right. So then the idea is we can follow this mode back and interpret it as a mode here, and then what we're going to do is demand that it's in its ground state here, and then see what that says about whether it's excited here. Now, if energy were conserved, then you would say if it's in the ground state, it's in the ground state. So if it's unexcited here, then it's not going to be excited there. But here, energy is not conserved, and it's not conserved for the reasons we've been discussing. So up here, there is a symmetry, which is this Schwarzschild time translation symmetry. But that symmetry is broken down here in the part of the geometry before the black hole was formed. Down here, there's a different symmetry. Well, so this is just a piece of Minkowski space. And then there's the symmetry just along these Minkowski kinds of slices. But the two symmetries don't match up on this line. So that means that it's possible that being in the ground state with respect to the Hamiltonian down here, you can still be in an excited state for the Hamiltonian up there. And what Hawking did in his paper was show that indeed that's the case. So these modes coming out are excited. And moreover, they're excited in a nice, simple way. So what he showed is that for each mode, there's an energy flux, which is given just in terms of the frequency of the mode. There's some absorption probability, I'll explain in a sec. And then there's this thermal factor like that, where this beta is indeed 1 over T Hawking that I just erased. Okay. And this is the formula that you would arrive at if you wanted to say that, you know, this was spontaneous emission from something that could be in equilibrium with something at temperature T. But you see, now we've derived it in this kind of physical way. We made the black hole, we said nothing else went in, and then we asked what comes out here. So this P, sometimes called the gray body factor, it's the absorption probability from this scattering problem. So what this P is saying is that if you take this mode that was coming out and you turn it around and you send it back this way, what's the probability that it gets through the barrier and goes into the black hole? So to figure that out, you have to solve this Schrodinger equation, which unfortunately actually can't be done analytically. And then you compute this absorption factor. So, you know, this is saying, indeed, black holes spontaneously radiate. Note that the height of this barrier grows with L. You can kind of see that from here. So it gets harder and harder to get through the barrier at higher and higher angular momentum. So what that means from this formula is that most of the radiation is coming out in the lowest angular momenta. So there's a flux of radiation coming out at infinity, but mostly in the lowest, you know, L equals 0, maybe L equals 1, you know, the lowest angular momentum modes of the field. So it's this very diffuse thing, right? It's not an easy thing to measure. You have sort of spherically symmetric modes coming out, you know, excited a few at a time with this temperature. All right. So maybe I'll just close by computing the lifetime, and then tomorrow we can go on to discuss explicitly the information problem. So what this formula says is that, well, so this is the energy flux into the radiation, right? But we could also interpret this. This causes the mass of the black hole to decrease with time, right? We can't compute this approximately because we don't know this P absorption. We would have to solve this differential equation. But there's an estimate, which is pretty good for the lowest L's, which is that this goes like omega squared. Okay. You can figure that out by doing some sort of WKB approximation to this. So then that tells us that dm dt of the black hole, roughly speaking, should go like 1 over mg squared. So that's not totally obvious. You have to substitute this in here and then do the integral over frequencies. But it's not too bad. If you don't care about the coefficient, you can just pull this out by scaling. It's not too hard to do the integral. And so then this has a solution. So we can solve this equation. I mean, even I can solve this equation. You can move the m over here, and it's a polynomial integral. So we find that m of t is the cube root of the initial mass minus t over g squared. Okay. So that means that, well, so then clearly we're going to evaporate, right? So the black hole will be gone when these two terms are equal. So then we see that the black hole has evaporation time, which is g squared m naught cubed. So it's the mass cubed, initial mass cubed in Planck units. That may look fairly innocuous, but for fun, right, so we could say that So in particular, say m naught is the mass of the sun. then the evaporation time of the sun is 10 to the 66 years. So that's a long time, much older than the age of the universe. And indeed, it's another reason why we're probably not going to test the unitarity of the evaporation of black holes in the lab. Certainly, we're going to have to, if we do, it's going to have to be a black hole which is much smaller than the mass of the sun. And since it's in Planck units, I mean, it's growing with the cube, it's going to have to be a pretty light black hole, even just if we want to watch it evaporate at all. And then once we decide black holes evaporate, and this will be the last thing, then we kind of need to update our Penrose diagram. So actually, I drew the updated one at the beginning of the lecture, but now I'll draw it again. So now we'll have a picture like that. Here's our infalling shell, and here's the horizon. So up here, we've got some Hawking radiation coming out that the black hole evaporated into. So that's the picture. This entanglement, which is present in low energy states in quantum field theory. So maybe it's not totally clear, so let me emphasize that here, right? So the reason why this mode was excited is because down here it had to be in the ground state. And well, it has a neighbor down here who also needs to be in the ground state. And that means these two guys have to be entangled, okay? So then when we evolve it up to here, that says this mode has to be entangled with that mode. So it has to be mixed, so there has to be flux coming out, right? So it's really this same Unruh kind of thing, right? It's the entanglement in the vacuum. Now it's the entanglement in the vacuum down here that leads to entanglement across the horizon here in this state where we made the black hole. That leads to this flux of energy out at infinity, which then causes the black hole to evaporate. All right, so tomorrow I guess we'll discuss the information problem.
Thank you. I think we can take one or two urgent questions.
I thought that the whole logic of the Rindler calculation was that you start from a pure state and it looks thermal because you're looking at a subregion.
Yeah.
But then when you discuss the Hawking argument, you keep on saying, okay, you have a mixed state, which is correct because you're looking at, again, maybe perhaps outside a black hole, someone from...
Yeah.
But this, the way you initially posed the question that a pure state is going to the somehow mixed state, but that sounds like a not the someone has to probably say more words there that it's maybe no, if you look no, at no, a,
yeah. So we haven't discussed the information problem yet, except at the beginning, right? So yeah, that's what Ted was complaining about at the beginning, is he was saying that well, this is still just a part of the system; the other part is over here.
Right. If I had a wave function for the whole inside plus outside together.
Yeah, that's right.
Then,
So tomorrow we'll discuss in more detail why we think that maybe there should be a unitary description just outside.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other question? Okay. If not, let's thank Daniel.